accession number 27083, reel 11.
So Henry, you were mentioning that Royal Sovereign was being worked up before being handed over to the Russians.
Yes, she came up Scarpa, and we did everything we could to help and so forth. And she was given an escort of, I forget how many, about four, ex-American four-stacker destroyers. But they did not have the legs to get the whole way back to Russia without refueling. And they hadn't practiced this. They didn't know the technique and so forth. And so us watchkeeping officers and Duke of York used to take in turns to go out with them to act as instructors, almost, for fueling at sea. And it was a very difficult job because they were extremely unresponsive and they didn't want to be told anything, and they resented any suggestion which was different to what they had been doing, which was almost invariably wrong anyway, and so forth. It was quite tricky. And then one day they invited, I forget what the number was, something like 15, from the Duke of York, because we were really the chummy ship, over one Sunday for lunch. And we fielded the first lieutenant. I meant that in quotes, not the official first lieutenant. We fielded the first 11, I should have said, the first 11 team for this, because we weren't quite sure what we were in for. And it was just as well we did. It was pretty ghastly. The wardroom, which was old-fashioned anyway, was festooned with sort of heavy magenta drapes and so on. And as soon as you crossed the threshold, a chap came along and filled your glass with what you sincerely hoped was gin, but of a, you know, watered down and so forth. But it wasn't watered down at all. It was neat gin. They got gin because it was difficult to get vodka, I think, and so on. And so it went on. And when you complain, because it, you know, I don't awfully like neat gin. I like my stiff ones, but not neat. And when you ask for if you could have a bit of water, they come round with a jug, but it was more neat gin. And that was the way they played it. And then we went into lunch, and in their usual way, the speeches were at the beginning, not at the end. And although we had poured a lot of stuff into a lot of flower pots by then, we were quite glad to sit down, to say the least. And again, they did the sort of scrawling act, and a chap would get up and propose a toast, and he was supposed to knock it off in one. You didn't, of course, and you didn't absolutely have to. But behind each of us was a chap with a decanter or a bottle topping you up and so forth. Well, then we got through that meal. I can't remember what we ate. And to our consternation, it was a lovely summer, sunny day, and they took us out on the quarterdeck to photograph us. And we were wavering a bit. And one chap missed his footing and fell down a hatch. And was immediately whisked away to their sick bay, and I don't know what happened to him there. And so forth. Well, we emerged all right. And that night, we were going to have them back on board for the usual supper and film. And the first 11 were in, you know, we hadn't really got our second wind by then, but so we had to play up. And we got through supper all right, and I forget what the film was, but it was ghastly. And it was totally inappropriate. And so after a bit, by sort of common consent, we stopped the film We stopped the film and took them out into the anteroom and gave them a glass of whiskey. And we then found that just as we'd been rather overcome by an excess of gin.
I'm sorry, Sir Henry, do continue, please.
We took them out into the anteroom and fed them with whiskey. And we very quickly found that they couldn't take whiskey. They weren't used to it and they couldn't take it. And they were stripping off sort of throat taut tunics. And underneath, the most astonishing selection of sort of prison vests, all different stripes and so forth. And after a couple of whiskies, they were away. So that was that one. It wasn't very impressive.
No.
And each evening at 10 o'clock, we would see them, what appeared to be the entire ship's company, gather on the forecastle for, presumably, the routine daily indoctrination or whatever. But we didn't make many friends there. Well, now, going on, I took over the forward turret, A turret, and you had to do rounds daily, magazine rounds. and it was, you know, that was a very sensible rule. I used to make a point, as well as going around the magazines, including the children's, of course, I would, in the course of certainly a month, poke my nose into every single corner of that turret, access to which, in a number of cases, was extremely torturous and difficult. And for this purpose, I would strip, literally, a jock strap and a pair of overalls and carry my torch. And I went round on my own because I didn't think it fair to take the chief gunnery instructor going crawling through all this lot and so on and so forth. And I noted things that were wrong and hopefully got them put right. And that was the way I played it. And I did this on one occasion. And it was about, I don't know, I'd cut it rather fine. It was about 11:30, 11:40, and the sailors went to dinner, their midday meal at noon. I got the magazines in the showrooms, come to that, were on different levels, and two were interlinked. And so from the handling room in the middle of the barbette, you went into one, and from that one you could go through a connecting door into the other. Then you had to come out, because you couldn't go round the full circle, as it were. And I'd been through one magazine, and I'd gone through into the next one. And when I came to the next one, I found that the door was locked. And I backtracked to where I'd gone in. And rather to my consternation, I found that door was locked too. Because the sweeper had locked up prior to going to his dinner. And I thought, pretty silly. And at about that point, the lights went out. And there was no switch down there because of electrical hazards and so forth. So I had my torch, and I thought, too bad. And the next thing that occurred to me was that I had the afternoon watch on the quarterdeck. And it was now just after midday. And I should be taking over in 25 minutes. And so on. And then I thought, the hands will turn too at 1:15. And they will come down and they'll open it all up again. And after that, so I shall feel a bit of an ass because it's entirely my own fault. But all will be well. And The next thing I recalled was that actually they would not be turning to at 1315 because a half holiday, a make amend, had been granted, and therefore they would not be turning to until 7:30 next morning. And that put a rather different complexion on it, because it was right down in the bottom of the ship, in Scarpa Flow, in winter, and it was bloody cold. So I thought, well, I'd noticed that the way the ammunition came out, the cordite charges and further up the shell and so forth, there was a heavy, watertight door, which you opened, of course, as soon as you went to action stations. And inside that, there was an almost as heavy brass door, known as a flash door, which was pushed up by the cage holding the cordite charge, and was, as its name implies, to stop flash going through from one magazine to another, Shades of Jutland and so forth. And I'd noticed that one of these watertight doors was down and was sort of partly stripped out, but not, of course, the flash door. And I thought, right, well, I will emulate a cordite charge and I will crawl through and I will get out that way. Little did I know how heavy the flash door was, and I very quickly found out. And it was about, I suppose, 3/4 of an inch of solid brass and about that square. And you could only get at it by lying on your back with your forearms bunched across your chest. So you couldn't get much leverage, and you certainly couldn't stand and pull or anything like that. And realizing how heavy it was, I thought, well, the important thing is to jam it in the up position. And I got hold of one of those tools for opening the cases of cordite, which were about 18 inches long. And I thought, if I can get the door up that high, I'll put this underneath, and that will give me enough room to crawl through in a nice way. And I did all this, and I got it up, and I got this tool jammed with the door sufficiently up that I could just about crawl through. And I started to do so. When suddenly there was a, I don't know what happened, but I must have touched the tool, and it slipped, and the door came down with a crash, and it cut my torch in half. Bang, just like that.
So and now I you're thought, in complete darkness.
What?
Now you're in complete darkness.
Now I was in complete darkness the whole time. Well, apart from the torch.
Yes.
Now I had no torch. And I thought, well, I was sweating a bit by this time. Because if it had been any portion of my anatomy, e.g. my softer middle part, I should have been cut in half. Sweating in that temperature wasn't much help. There was no means of communication whatsoever, because things like telephones were supposedly dangerous for a spark and so on. Again, Shades of Jutland. So I resigned myself. and I managed, I thought, well, I've got to be able to communicate out into the handling room and the rest of the turret. So with my, not very much by then, remaining strength, I jacked the door up again, a couple of inches. And I sat back to wait, getting colder and colder. And at about 3:30 in the afternoon, I thought I heard a noise from further up in the bulkhead. And I heard the noise again. So I'd positioned myself fairly close to the slit that remained, and at the top of my voice I shouted. And very much in due course, down came a very, very young ordnance artificer apprentice. And he came down into the cordite handling room. And rather unthinkingly, I spoke in a normal voice. And of course, he had a torch, but he didn't have any other light. And he heard this voice from the gloom. And what he thought, I don't know, but he panicked. And he fled. But I shouted again more comforting things like, you know, it's all right, it's all right, and so forth. And eventually I persuaded him to return. And I told him what to do, to go to the chief GI, the captain of the turret, and tell him to draw the keys and to let me out that fast. And he duly did this. And that was that. And I then had to apologize to my watchkeeping operators for having missed the whole of my afternoon watch. But at least I didn't have to wait until 7:30 next morning. So that taught me that you were a bit more careful before you went crawling around on your own at unusual hours.
I mean, what you really needed to do was to advise someone you were doing it, so that when you didn't appear, it would occur to them that...
Well, you could play it all sorts of ways, but the normal, the stuffy way of doing it was to take your captain and turret around with you.
Right.
And he then returned the keys and so forth.
Yes.
Anyway, there we were. And the next thing which I thought might be of passing interest, shortly before D-Day, Monty came up to Scarpa to visit the fleet. And us very sort of bolshy, rebellious, young watchkeeping officers thought, frankly, you know, well, what on earth is this funny little man with a blue and white spotted handkerchief and his British warm? What's he doing coming up to Scarpa? And how's he going to get on with Bruce Fraser? Because, as we saw it, Monty was in bed by 2200 and up by 06. And Bruce Fraser was seldom in bed much before midnight or up before 8. So how was that going to work out? And so on. And we thought the whole thing was very peculiar. And we were pretty pretty disparaging about it. And he was with us. I forget how long he was with us. It was something like 36 hours, that sort of thing. And it fell to me on the second day, at 9 o'clock in the forenoon, to show him round my, well, not the whole turret, but the gun house, and to do a loading cycle, which you could, without using live ammunition. But you went through all the motions and you laid the guns so that they could be loaded, and the ammunition loading trays moved into their various positions. A very noisy undertaking because of all the rammers coming out and so forth. And I met Monty on the forecastle, took him into my turret, introduced the captain of the turret, who was the senior chief petty officer, and to each of the captains of the guns, who again were either petty officers or senior leading hands, explained what we were going to show him, the loading cycle, and the fact that I couldn't explain anything during the cycle because of the racket, and so on. And he was, he had a few words to say to each, and so forth. We'd ended the loading cycle, and that was it. And I said, that's it, sir, I'm afraid. And he turned and just sort of said, "Adjournal, thank you very much. I appreciated that." And left, and I saw him off. He then went after something else. And I hopped back into the gun house after he'd gone to thank the boys for doing their stuff. And I had a chat with each one. And it was quite interesting. And I'd never experienced it to the same extent with anybody else at any other time. Whichever one you talked to, who might have been in some doubt, as indeed was I, what the hell Monty was coming up for, knew exactly. And he'd come up to see me or me, whoever the individual was. And that was a remarkable situation, I think. I've never forgotten it. Shortly afterwards, the Bruce Fraser's Flag Lieutenant was sent to sea to gain a bit of experience. And he was an RNVR lieutenant. And for a week, I acted as acting flag lieutenant to Bruce Fraser, who could not have been nicer or more charming about it. He was the most marvellous man. And then I'd said earlier that Captain Creasy's successor, Brian Schofield, was only with us for a short time because his wife was so ill. And the night before we sailed for what in the event turned out to be the Scharnhorst action, but that was a bit later, we went via Iceland and so forth before we got into that action. And the night before we sailed for that, the captain of the Nelson, the Honourable Guy Russell, came over and took over command of the Duke of York. A very unusual situation to switch from one battleship to another in the middle of a war like that, but there it was. He was a superman. He was a good sort of 6 foot four, 6 foot four tall and well built. He was very much a Londoner, and he had the habit of describing, by way of commendation or reproof, by comparison with London streets. And so if you were manoeuvring at sea and you were following in the wake of a ship ahead, and you got it right, and you did follow in the wake, he would sit in his chair, and there were quite small bridges in those ships, despite the size of the ship. He would sit in his chair, very close to him, sort of mutter delightedly, Bond Street. But if you made a cock of it, he'd say, depending on the level of the cock, he'd growl and say, that was pretty Whitechapel. And you knew to a T exactly what he thought. But he was a marvellous man. Well, we went up to Iceland, and then we went on, and we stood off because the convoys, which had been stopped because of the sinkage rate during the light summer months, and had been restarted, and the method that restarting took was really to act as a bit of a tempting trap for the Scharnhorst, who was at the time dominating those northern waters. The mere fact that she was there, and who had to provide heavy escort, quite apart from anti-submarine escorts and so forth. And it was arranged that there were three convoys at sea at that time. One approaching Russia, one coming away from Russia, and one, a third one, a bit further south, ultimately to go to Russia. Something like that. And I forget precisely when. The action itself occurred on Boxing Day, 26th of December, 44, I suppose. Yes, 44. We knew what was going on. We knew why we were there. We knew that the Scharnhorst might or might not do its thing. And we knew that the trap was set for her. And so we were all a bit tensed up. And something like 24 hours before, it's Christmas Day, I suppose, certainly Christmas Eve, and word came through that the Scharnhorst, I think we got something out of Coastal Command too, to say that she'd sailed. I can't remember that too clearly. But word came through that she had made a pass at the South Coming convoy and been driven off by Belfast and I forget who else. There was another cruiser there, and a destroyer attack was put into her. And she made a second pass at either that or the next convoy, and had again been driven off. And Bruce Fraser had a quite tricky decision to make as to whether Scharnhorst was going to try to break out into the Atlantic and act as a raider, or whether she would say, well, enough's enough, and I have failed in my attack, in the plural, on these convoys, and I will return to a Norwegian base. And he reckoned on the latter, and in fact he was right. And throughout the whole of that Christmas night, we went to action stations about 8 o'clock that night. We were miles away, but in those days it was quite the done thing to go to a so-called night action station, break down to what was termed the second degree of readiness, whereby all hands slept at their quarters, which is another way of saying they didn't get much sleep, but at least they wouldn't be jumped. And the weather was foul. It was blowing a full gale, and it was ghastly. And even the big ship like Duke of York was bucketing around like a... it was hopeless. And I don't suppose anybody got much in the way of sleep or much in the way of food, because the action messing, whereas nowadays you tell off parties to go down to the cafeteria and you have 20 minutes off at a time and that sort of thing. In those days, you sent a couple of hands down with buckets, and slush was put in the buckets, and they took them back to their quarters. And the slush was pork, and it was fatty pork, and it was swimming in greasy gravy, and it was enough to turn any normal mortal up, and it did a number. And it was bitterly cold. Well, we spent the whole of that night. And our fear was, of course, that somehow Scharnhorst would slip through and we wouldn't have a go at her. And that went on. We wake up next morning and there wasn't really much more news. And then at about...
I'm sorry, is the ship's company informed from time to time? It's kept informed?
Very much so, yes. And that's either done by the captain, or it's done as often as not by the commander, who just keeps them in touch as far as you can. And for that sort of situation, there was no security problem about it. So everybody on board knew what the score was, and everybody wondered. And then about, as I recall, about 3 o'clock that afternoon...
I'm going to ask you to stop, if I may, for a moment.